Security is the outcome of relationships. It is the outcome of a resolution of conflicts. Countries have different sense of vulnerability and therefore different interests when it comes to managing these very difficult relationships.
Do you think, Karim, the nuclear option will be more in focus for Middle Eastern countries?
Some states have argued that since Iran has nuclear capabilities, then certainly should be a case.
For decades, the assumption was simple. More military power meant more stability. But what if that's no longer true? Because today, some of the strongest states in the Middle East still behave like they're one shock away from chaos. And maybe the real story is bigger than the region itself. Maybe the Middle East isn't breaking the global order. Maybe it's revealing what the future of it looks like. Welcome to From Cairo to New York, Power and Pressure in a New Middle East. I'm Zeina Soufan. My guest today is Karim Haggag, director at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, a leading global independent institute dedicated to research into conflict, armaments, arms control, and disarmament. I chose Karim for this conversation because he brings a rare combination of regional expertise, diplomatic experience, and strategic insight at a moment when old assumptions about order, security, and stability are rapidly eroding. Together, we explore what the Middle East reveals about the future of global power and why the region may no longer be an exception to the international system, but a preview to where it's heading. Karim, why do even the most militarily capable states in the Middle East appear increasingly insecure today? Has the region entered an era where no actor fully believes stability can be guaranteed anymore?
So yes, so the Middle East is one of the most heavily militarized regions globally. So at SIPRI, we track military expenditures on an annual basis and a global basis. For 2026, military expenditures in the Middle East reached a record high of $218 billion. That is roughly a 35% increase over the last decade. Israel alone has doubled its military expenditure. Now, to get to your question, Zeina, military expenditures and military resources in and of themselves rarely bring security. Security is the outcome of relationships. It is the outcome of a resolution of conflicts. It is an outcome of trust and confidence building. When you rely solely on military capabilities without these other pillars of security, what we have is exactly what we see in the region, a highly insecure, highly volatile regional security landscape. And the premise of your question is absolutely right. We are in a situation in which none of the major regional actors can take for granted their security, precisely because the assumption has been that reliance on military means alone affords security.
Karim, for a period of time, there seemed to be some form of regional order that was holding sometimes, collapsing sometimes, but never what we're seeing today. One has the impression that some assumptions about the regional order no longer hold after what we've seen, Gaza, the Red Sea crisis, these years of fragmented conflict. What's your take on that?
So yes, so many things have changed over the course of the last decade. What we've seen is conflicts that have remained unresolved, and therefore the nature of these conflicts is changing. We are seeing a trend whereby conflicts are defined in existential terms. We've clearly seen that with the round of armed confrontation after the October 7th attacks, where you see military objectives formed in or articulated in maximalist terms. So the complete elimination of the adversary. this is the frame that we see with respect to the conflict between Israel and Iran. So that was one very important shift that we see. Another very important shift, we've seen the return of interstate war, so full-fledged armed conflict between states, whereas during the last decade, what we've seen is a pattern of conflict in which the conflicts were within states, and the state involvement has been through intervention in these intrastate conflicts by proxies. And then perhaps the biggest shift we've seen is the changing role of the United States. For decades, the United States has been, in effect, not just a global power, but a regional power. The United States is the most important security actor in the Middle East today. The shift that we're seeing is the role of the United States from a status quo power to a revisionist power. The United States is now actively attempting to change the regional order, whether intentionally or unintentionally. Maybe that's a question we can discuss. All of these factors combined produce a highly destabilizing regional security landscape. And this is precisely why none of the regional actors can take their security for granted today.
Would you say, Karim, that the Middle East has become the world's first truly post-predictability region?
No, so yes. I mean, for decades, the region has been characterized by a high degree of volatility. But what we are seeing now globally in terms of overall security trends is that the Middle East is not alone. So we see the same type of uncertainty with respect to European security, for example, the changing nature of the transatlantic alliance, the war in Ukraine. So the first, the biggest armed conflict on the continent since the end of the Second World War. In East Asia, you see a very heightened geopolitical competition between China, the United States, Russia, with other powers assuming a much more prominent regional security role. So Japan, for example, the existence of multiple nuclear powers, so China, North Korea, the United States, of course, Russia. So we are seeing greater uncertainty when it comes to other regions. Maybe what distinguishes the Middle East is certainly its long history of conflict, but maybe also the absence of any durable mechanisms for not just the resolution of these conflicts, but the management of these conflicts. So no security system whereby the effects of these conflicts can be mitigated.
One could say, Karim, that the region adapted earlier than others, perhaps to fragmented power, proxy systems, and chronic instability. What strategic lessons are major powers drawing from Middle Eastern conflict patterns now?
I think there are many lessons to be drawn. I think one important lesson, it relates to the limited utility of military force. So we've seen now the most powerful military actors globally and regionally, the United States and Israel, unable to impose a decisive military outcome on a much weaker adversary, in this case, Iran. We also see one very important effect, which is the global spillover of regional conflicts. So this ties to an increasing trend of weaponization. In this case, the weaponization of a major maritime choke point, the Strait of Hormuz, and you alluded to the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. And this, of course, has global implications. So it has global implications on energy flows, on food security, on knock-on effects with other industries, the semiconductor industry, for example. So that, I think, is one important lesson. And I think maybe the related to that is the real questioning of alliance relationships. So the fact that so many rising powers now have relied for decades on the United States for their security, Europe, of course, being one, Japan, South Korea, and Asia being others. Now there's a real questioning as to whether the alliance relationship with the United States actually affords security, or contributes to greater insecurity when it comes to their overall strategic posture.
What would you say has been most strikingly revealed about the vulnerability of global systems at this point?
So over the course of the last few decades, I mean, since the end of the Cold War, what we've seen is a rising tide of globalization. The interconnected flows of finance, of capital, of energy, of information, of people, of supply chains. And during a time when you had relatively global, a situation of global stability, that, of course, led to overall prosperity. Mm. Now, with the return of great power competition, what we see is a trend whereby these interdependencies are becoming extremely weaponized. So the weaponization of global supply chains, the weaponization on the part of China of its monopoly on critical minerals, for example, rare earths, the weaponization of global choke points, the weaponization of technology inputs, so semiconductors, for example, the weaponization of food, of humanitarian assistance in the context of ongoing conflicts, Ukraine, Gaza, Lebanon. So all of these are heightening the sense of vulnerability. And this, unfortunately, is a trend that is likely to continue. And it goes back to the spillover effects of whereby the effects of regional conflicts spill over into the global arena.
Karim, we've seen, as you've mentioned before, how in this region it's been demonstrated that small actors actually can impose strategic costs once only reserved for states. And at the same time, can we say that we're entering an era of influence where actually dominance is more and more created or imposed by the ability to create disruption, no matter your size, your strengths, your military capabilities?
Yes, so clearly this relates to a convergence of factors. So on the one hand, yes, we do see the ability of weaker powers to impose asymmetric costs. Iran is certainly the clearest example we have today. The ability to escalate asymmetrically, so rather than keep the conflict confined to one between the US and Israel on the one hand and Iran on the other, Iran has escalated. It has escalated regionally in the Gulf. It has escalated by attacking U.S. targets throughout the region. And of course, it has escalated asymmetrically by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, so imposing global costs on the United States and its allies and the world economy. That relates to another very important trend, which is the economics of military power. And here we see a trend whereby weaker powers can actually project power at much lower cost. So if you look at the average cost of an Iranian missile, we are talking something in the low thousands of dollars. The cost of an interceptor missile from a missile defense system, whether that is the THAAD system or the Israeli Arrow system, is orders of magnitude higher. And so this has a major impact on the economics of warfare in general. Lesser powers can impose costs and can exhaust the resources of major powers, which have a much higher military capability. So yes, the prospect for disruption, the prospect for asymmetric cost, which again goes to this broader trend of the limitations of military power. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, that military capabilities alone, even superior, much superior military capabilities, cannot enforce durable outcomes.
What does this changed understanding of what power looks like? What are the implications of this change in understanding?
Yes, so for a long time, power has assumed a much more multidimensional quality. You know, power For a long time, power was measured in terms of hard capabilities, so hard power, military power, economic power, financial power. Over the last few decades, we've seen countries being able to deploy forms of soft power, so culture, the ability to impact global narratives, the ability to influence global discourse. And so we are talking certainly about a multidimensional role of power that has always been important in our region, in the Middle East. I mean, countries have deployed symbolic power as a form of projecting influence, projecting security. If we look at the decades of heightened conflict in the Middle East, you know, during the Arab Cold War, whereby countries like Egypt were able to project ideological power in the form of pan-Arabism. The Gulf, Saudi Arabia, certainly exercises a tremendous amount of soft power through its commanding position within global Islam, through its commanding position within the Gulf. And so, yes, you have a very multidimensional form of power. That is, that's a complex relationship between hard power and soft power. But we do now see a trend whereby countries rely much more for their security on hard power and forgetting the importance of soft power in building relationships, in fostering a sense of confidence, in actually resolving conflicts. So that, I think, is a very... is an unfortunate trend, and hopefully one that can be reassessed.
Doesn't it, in a way, respond to the fact that while countries in the region are seeking de-escalation, but yet they have a feeling that they need to prepare for the worst-case scenarios and that would require further hard power?
Yes, so that gets to this trend whereby conflicts are defined in existential terms. Mm. So countries are actually preparing for worst-case scenarios. That prompts an increased reliance on military capabilities out of a sense of guarding against these worst-case scenarios. But here, I think there's an important shift underway. Mm. You know, for decades, countries in the region have relied on external sources of security. So the Gulf states, for example, relying on the United States as a security guarantor. And that, I think, is an assumption that may be revisited after this conflict. What we've seen is that rather than provide security, the United States has actually exacerbated the sense of insecurity. So countries that have relied on the United States for protection are now less secure. Mm. U.S. bases in the region, rather than providing security and assurance, have become a target in this conflict. And so there may be a rethinking about where security comes from, and a greater reliance on countries' own power to provide security.
Does this, Karim, explain why some Middle Eastern states have been able to adapt to instability more effectively than others?
Yes, so countries in the region have had their own coping mechanisms to mitigate the effects of this insecurity. What we've seen is a trend towards diversification of security relationships. So rather than rely on the United States alone or Russia alone, we've seen a much more diverse portfolio of security relationships. That certainly applies to the countries in the Gulf, that applies to Egypt, even Israel to a certain extent. Iran is trying to diversify its security relationships, you know, but with the reliance on China, with a very strong relationship with Russia. And so that is certainly one trend we are seeing. What we've also seen is a trend that predates this war towards de-escalation. So we've seen agreements to de-escalate the conflict between the Gulf countries and Iran, the de-escalation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Tehran, the agreement that preceded that between the UAE and Iran. So an attempt to contain the conflicts precisely out of a realization that the outbreak of a full-fledged armed conflict would present real insecurities in a situation of real uncertainty in terms of the reliance on the United States as a security guarantor.
Given that, what does strategic survival look like in this region where more and more crises seem to be overlapping?
Yeah, so the conflicts in the region have always been interlinked. Mm. This was a deliberate strategy that was weaponized by Iran for decades, you know, the so-called unity of the fronts, linking its central conflict with the United States to other proxy conflicts across the region. Mm. So linking the conflict in the Gulf to Lebanon, to Palestine, to Yemen, to Iraq, using those linkages to bring the conflict directly to its adversaries, primarily Israel. So yes, we do see the linkages of these conflicts that have been weaponized for strategic effects. We see the symbolic linkage of the Palestinian issue, which is widely recognized to be the core issue of instability in the region. So the spillover effects of the war in Gaza. What we've seen is a thoroughly regionalized conflict that extended across multiple fronts. Again, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, eventually to Iran itself, and eventually to the Gulf. That is certainly should be an impetus to giving serious consideration to a regional security architecture that begins to address these conflicts, to put these conflicts on a path towards conflict resolution, and then to provide a framework for the security of the region in a comprehensive sense that provides a sense of security for all parties and begins to reverse this dynamic of existential conflict to one of coexistence, even if not peace, but coexistence, the ability to actually coexist with adversaries.
But Karim, some argue that Israel is going towards a complete militarization of its foreign policy at the moment. What would you say?
After October 7th, there has been a dramatic shift in Israel's security posture. Whereas before October 7th, the emphasis was on deterring adversarial threats, after October 7th, the overall objective is the elimination of these threats altogether. So what we've seen is a posture based on a sense of absolute security, the elimination of any and all threats that could pose any challenge to Israel's security or its regional interests. This is what we've seen in terms of the Israel's move to destroy Syria's military capabilities completely after the change of regime that took place earlier. This is what we've seen in terms of defining the objectives against Iran in maximalist terms. So eliminating Iran from the regional equation for a generation, at least. Clearly, this is what we've seen in terms of the Israeli response in Gaza, the Israeli response in Lebanon, to a large extent in the West Bank as well. So overall, a hyper-militarized, highly securitized approach to Israel's foreign policy and security doctrine, which clearly has been a source of volatility overall in the region.
But this has not achieved any sense of stability or security, even for Israel.
Precisely because it is completely divorced from any durable political relationships. So What we've seen, for example, at the end of the 2006, the second Israel-Lebanon war, what we've seen is the end of the war, which was quite messy, but anchored in Security Council resolutions, arrangements on the ground that maintained a system of a situation of ceasefire for at least a decade, if not more. And that was a political arrangement that had some durability. We've seen the United States, even between with a country which it has a deep adversarial relationship, Iran, reach a political agreement in the form of the Iranian nuclear deal under the Obama administration, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So these are durable political arrangements, even with adversaries. So that clearly signals an approach that does not rely on military force alone. It's the reliance on force or the threat of force that is coupled with a political arrangements that can guarantee security or at least impose some form of stability. What we see now is an Israeli approach completely divorced from any desire to reach any political accommodation with its adversaries.
I was going to ask, can we go back to these political arrangements now that so many red lines have been crossed in the region?
I think there is a grudging recognition in the region that, yes, at some point, there has to be a return to some form of political accommodation with adversaries, even if it's a situation we don't necessarily call peace. So, for example, in Gulf capitals, there's a clear recognition, even though the relationship with Iran has now shifted to one of open armed conflict. There clearly is a recognition that at some point, this is a regional state, a neighboring state. There has to be some form of political accommodation with Iran, even if it's a difficult one. Within Israel, we see no such tendency to go back to a reliance on political arrangements. That may or may not change with a potential change of government in Israel. There certainly is a sense of unease on the part of certain circles in Israel that do see the need to go back to some form of political approach to address these conflicts, simply out of a recognition that reliance on military means alone is unsustainable.
But even in the Gulf, Karim, wouldn't it be kind of simplistic to speak of the Gulf all as one front in the approach towards, for instance, a renewed rapprochement with Iran?
No, of course. There are differing approaches. And Iran will make an effort to exploit those differences. So yes, you will see differences in approach between certain Gulf capitals with respect to how to manage the conflict with Iran, how and when to deal with the greater volatility in terms of the U.S. posture in the region, so the uncertainty in terms of the alliance relationship with Washington, yes, you will see differing approaches. And again, that is not a surprise. Countries have a different sense of vulnerability and therefore different interests when it comes to managing these very difficult relationships. But one can, I think, hope that there will be an overall recognition of going back to what we had before, which is at least modest steps towards de-escalation of the overall conflict with Iran, and hopefully putting that relationship back on a political track.
To what extent, Karim, is this related to the fact that the Middle East has really revealed something about the limits of international institutions and what they can do during these prolonged conflicts?
Yeah, so this has been a global trend. The breakdown of frameworks for conflict resolution, the breakdown of frameworks for regional security, the breakdown of global frameworks for arms control, for example, for disarmament, the weakening of overall multilateral frameworks for addressing global issues, that has been a source of tension or a product of the tension we've seen now on the global stage, especially with the return of great power competition. So that is an ongoing global trend. In the region, what we have seen is a mix of external intervention to address conflicts in the region. But we've also seen, and this is a hopeful sign, that actors in the region take responsibility for addressing the conflicts in the Middle East. So we've seen the very proactive and intensive mediation efforts on the part of regional states, Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. There seems to be a much more diplomatic activism to take charge of to take the burden of addressing these conflicts. That effort is still somewhat needs to be developed, needs to be institutionalized, but overall this is a positive trend that may compensate for the retreat of global institutions when it comes to conflict resolution.
And may take perhaps the region into a new era of self-managed competition?
Yeah, so I think there is a growing recognition in regional capitals that the ownership for regional security has to come from the region itself. That is still a tenuous process. We still see a tendency to rely on external actors for security. However, given the real uncertainties, especially with the changing role and posture of the United States, that, again, as we've said, no longer can be guaranteed to provide security. So hopefully we will see greater ownership on the part of a greater role by regional states for providing not only for their own regional security, but taking ownership of devising a regional security framework to address the chronic sense of volatility and insecurity in the region.
But it does look like, until now, at least, Karim, that regional actors are more adapting to instability rather than trying to really eliminate it.
Yes, I think that's true. What we are seeing, precisely because of the really heightened sense of insecurity and vulnerability, that states are acting in a very short term, with a very short term calculus, to address the very existential threats to their security today. So yes, this should be no surprise. So in most regions, this involves a decades-long effort to begin addressing, mitigating the sources of immediate insecurity, but also beginning to think seriously about a pathway for the region that would change the dynamics. So changing the dynamics from relying on war to relying on politics and diplomacy to address regional conflicts and the clash of regional interests. And so this is always a long-term process, but there's no doubt that we are in a situation of acute vulnerability for states in the region today.
And what does deterrence look like in this transitional period where trust is yet to be built and resolutions yet to be reached?
So as is the case with many other regions that are experiencing the state of security uncertainty, we see a deterrence posture that is based on capabilities alone. So the assumption being that military capabilities guarantee deterrence. But that, of course, is a very narrow view of deterrence. Deterrence relies on two pillars. One is certainly capabilities, But the other is reassurance. Reassurance in terms of confidence-building measures, reassurance in terms of communication of red lines so that there's no uncertainty as to the vital interests of each side, reassurance in terms of crisis management mechanisms, crisis communications channels. All of these things are important, not for peace, but to stabilize adversarial relationships. Without that second pillar of reassurance, deterrence actually fails. The clearest example of this is Israel. So Israel is by far the most powerful military actor in the region. And deterrence failed. Deterrence failed on October 7th. Deterrence failed in terms of dissuading Iran from launching large-scale missile attacks against Israeli cities. Deterrence has failed in stopping Hezbollah attacks against Israeli targets in northern Israel. And so and I raise this example because it's an extreme case of relying on military capabilities alone for the purposes of deterrence, which, as we have seen, does not work.
Do you think, Karim, the nuclear option will be more in focus for Middle Eastern countries who were never previously interested in pursuing that kind of power?
So I think what you are seeing is not so much a case of nuclear proliferation, but you are seeing a trend towards nuclear hedging, meaning developing or beginning to take an interest in the capabilities that could provide pathways for a more sophisticated nuclear program in the future, and in extreme circumstances, actually weaponizing these capabilities. So that has actually been articulated by some states. Some states have argued that since Iran has nuclear capabilities, then there certainly should be a case for the development of national nuclear capabilities in response. And so that is certainly a possibility. I think we are still in the very early stages of that. These things take a very long time to develop. That said, I think much will depend on two things. One is the outcome of the conflict with Iran with respect to the status of its nuclear program.
Okay.
So its nuclear program has certainly been degraded. However, we are entering a situation of a gray zone where we know less about the status of the program. We know less about Iran's actual capabilities. We know much less about Iran's intent when it comes to the nuclear program. The intent may have changed from using the nuclear program as a bargaining chip to actually moving to a full-fledged nuclear capability. The other factor, of course, is whether we move also in terms of a regional framework for addressing weapons of mass destruction comprehensively. And this gets to the Israel problem. So Israel has for decades been outside of the non-proliferation regime. Any regional security framework must address all weapons of mass destruction capabilities in the region, including those of Israel.
And who would take the lead on that, Karim?
Again, this is the question, whether countries in the region will take the lead, or would be a concerted effort with the international community as a whole. So the goal of establishing a weapons of mass destruction free zone is now globally recognized and institutionalized in the form of a UN process. So there is a UN conference, an ongoing annual conference, mandated by the UN General Assembly for precisely this objective. And so there is an international consensus on achieving that goal. That said, again, this is a long-term endeavor, and it happens incrementally. But certainly it has to be a combination of both regional impetus, but also global action.
Would you say, Karim, that the resolution of the current conflict in the region is being closely watched because somewhat it is showing not an exception, but rather a preview of what the world might be looking like going forward?
Yeah, I think the ongoing armed conflict is closely watched by key capitals across the globe to try and draw lessons as to the changing character of armed conflict, the changing role of emerging technologies, which has been very interesting in terms of how they were deployed and used in this conflict, the implications for the global posture, the global military posture of the United States. So the implications of this war for the global readiness of U.S. forces in other regions, in Europe, in East Asia, for example. How would all of these factors influence a future conflict over Taiwan, for example, or the outbreak of another conflict on the European continent, another front other than Ukraine? So all of these things are being watched closely. And clearly what we've seen, and this has been a recurring pattern in the region, is that the Middle East has proven to be a testbed for not just military technologies, but different ways of warfare. And so the Middle East seems to be a testing ground for new approaches to armed conflict that could play out in other regions.
If the Middle East has learned to operate without predictability, Karim, is that where the rest of the world is heading?
Yeah, clearly there's a convergence. So again, the Middle East is not the only region today that is seeing greater volatility, greater uncertainty when it comes to security dynamics and military dynamics. So there is a convergence. However, clearly, again, what distinguishes the Middle East is that it has been one of the few regions without a viable regional security framework for decades. Other regions have had a framework, but those frameworks are now breaking down. But there is that precedent of systems and mechanisms to address sources of conflict and mitigate those sources. The Middle East has been starting from scratch for decades. And so we've had a situation in the region whereby conflicts have festered without resolution, which is why the nature of these conflicts are changing, because they've been going on for such a long time. So these are very entrenched dynamics in the region, in the Middle East, whereas in other regions, in Europe, in East Asia, they are evolving, but maybe from a different baseline than they are in the Middle East.
Karim, thank you so much. If the Middle East has learned to operate without predictability, then maybe the real question is whether the rest of the world is beginning to look more and more like the region. Fragmented power, constant pressure, overlapping crises, and states adapting to permanent uncertainty. My thanks to you, Karim Hagag, for joining me for this conversation. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to From Cairo to New York, Power and Pressure in a New Middle East. I'm Zeina Soufan. See you next time.